Good morning. It is good to be here. I really enjoy coming to visit you here at Northwest Bible Chapel. My family likes to visit too. They're not here with me today. My wife and daughter were headed to Lake Geneva this morning. My daughter's her last year of teen camp. My wife is going to be working in the She was supposed to be working in the canteen. She found out she'll be cooking. She's really, really happy about that. My boys, and when I left yesterday morning, or yesterday afternoon, they were working, and so they're not with me. But maybe next week I'll have one or two, we'll see, because they like to visit here as well. But it's been good. I should catch you up a little bit. I was asked already about how my COVID recovery is doing. I'm doing well. I'm feeling much better and stronger. I have some permanent damage to my lungs, which doesn't cause a lot of issues because I'm not playing basketball every day again like I used to. And so that's not a real issue. I'm getting enough oxygen. My only issue, especially when I'm teaching, and you might even notice that today, is that I have the COVID brain, the fog, every once in a while. I'll be in the middle of a conversation, and where I'm going with that statement just goes away. And so I'll figure it out about 3 minutes later and come back to it. And so you'll probably notice as I'm speaking today on the message, I might get to a point and I'll say, more could be said. That means I forgot what I was going to say about that, and we'll go from there. Okay, and so we'll keep on moving. But it's good to be here. I don't see Laura here. There she is. Okay. My wife and I went to Hawaii, and she wanted to give mucho thank yous to her for all the help and giving, because she's the resident Hawaii expert here. And so they were online back and forth, all the thanks. We had a great time. We loved being there. We'd love to go again, probably in the next life. It was a one time. We spent a lot of money, but we had a good time doing those things. It was awesome. We really enjoyed that. So thank you very much for Laura for that as well. It's interesting. Hawaii, you know, everybody thinks it's paradise, and it is beautiful, but it's not heaven. Even while we were there, we were walking along a sidewalk in one of the cities there. And I'm stepping over people laying on the street. And you go, how, you're wondering, how in the world? But there's homeless people there. There's drug addiction there. There's crime. And it's one of those things where you're driving along and you're looking at the ocean or the mountains, and you're just like, this is just beautiful. And all of a sudden you drive past the cemetery. You go, this is not heaven, because there's all the problems of sin are still even in a place like that. And so it was wonderful, a great trip, but it's good. Yes, good to be here today. So my message today, I'm going to get into that, is basically my motivation is what at Arbor Oaks Bible, Asbury Road Bible Chapel was going through while from January through May in our care groups. We are doing a study. This is Ken Fleming's new ECS book at Emmaus. And so we always do that to help encourage our Emmaus brothers and that kind of thing. Ken Fleming did a very nice job. This deals with basically the first 12 chapters of Genesis, which is, as it turns out, to be the most controversial books or chapters of the Bible. Okay, that's the most argued are these chapters in Genesis. And so today I'm going to discuss that. We're going to go through all 12 chapters, not in detail, okay? But one of the outcomes of that conversation was that, yes, we've gone through these chapters before, but we never put it all together before. Why is that here? The importance of the context of what's going on. Why was this written? My other motivation comes from an article I read. This is from Newsweek. I read it online. It's from Newsweek a few months ago. And you guys have heard of Dr. Stephen Meyer. He's a PhD in philosophy and science. So he's written three really, really big books. He's a very strong advocate of the intelligent design movement. I'm not a favor of everything they do, but there's a lot of stuff they do that I'm interested in. I like science, I like math, and they do a lot of stuff in that area. And so Stephen Meyer wrote an article. It's an opinion piece. It's not a science piece. It's an opinion piece based on some things. And the Gallup poll shows that a percentage of Americans who believe in God has fallen to 81%. Well, 81%, that's still a B minus. That's not too bad, right? But it's a drop of 10% over the last decade and an all-time low. So it seems like the belief in God in America is dropping very rapidly. Okay, that's very quickly. Especially with young adults, between 18 and 29-year-olds are now atheists, agnostics, and religiously unaffiliated. Why is that so important? Because 18 to 29-year-olds are an important part of a church as well, right? That is the future leadership of a church to keep it going. And if all of those are starting to lose their faith that even God exists, the church is going to struggle in the future. It goes on. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the perceived message of science has played a leading, this is Stephen Meyer's perspective. The perceived, I'm emphasizing perceived message of science has played a leading role in the loss of faith. It was showed that 65% of self-described atheists and 43% of agnostics believe the findings of science make the existence of God less probable. And so science is leading them astray. That kind of disheartens me because I teach science. I love science. Science is good. Okay. So where do we go? What kind of questions do we need to deal with here? So the point is, if there is no God, right, if that's what they're looking at, then is this God's word? No, it doesn't make it. It's not true. So how do I go to this to convince them about their need for salvation? This is God's word. But if I don't believe in God, so we have that problem. The problem is he has noticed that it's the perceived billing of science. I'm not going to talk about science today. I'm talking about the Bible, but this is the background. So Stephen Meyer then goes off and says this: over the last century, important scientific discoveries have dramatically challenged science-based atheism, and three in particular now tell a decidedly more God-friendly story. So the scientists are pointing, science proves points against God, but now in the last 100 years, what he's saying is science actually points towards God. You're saying just what you're telling the people is wrong. You're lying. Can you believe they would lie about something like that? What would somebody call that in the news today? Fake news, right? That's what we're talking about there. But going forward, first, I'm going to list them very quickly. The physical universe had a beginning. Well, that's been known for over 100 years now. But 100 years ago, 100 is a long time ago, but for history, it's a short period of time. 100 years ago, the leading scientists, Albert Einstein as one of them, believed the universe was eternal. That got them rid of worrying about the idea that that there needed a beginning. If there was a beginning, the obvious conclusion would be there would be a beginner to that process. Well, we learned, and now the Big Bang cosmology comes out. I'm not going to argue about that today, but you have the fact of the matter is there was a beginning to this universe. That points to a design or a beginner, so to speak. That was number one. In fact, Nobel laureate Arnold Penzias writes this: the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted. This is about the beginning of the universe. Had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses. In other words, this is not a Christian saying this. Okay, in other words, he's saying, like, if I just had Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, what I see in the universe would have been exactly what I predicted going forward. And so it kind of points in that direction. Second, so the beginning of the universe. Second, and this is one of Meyer's areas, Physicists have determined that the fundamental physical laws and the parameters of our universe are finely tuned against all odds to make our universe capable of hosting life. In fact, the mathematical odds of all this happening by chance are zero, less than zero, which is, you know, in that perspective. And so this is one of the areas that Myers is focused on. And third, one of his big things is the molecular biology has revealed the presence of living cells, an exquisite world of informational nanotechnology, DNA and RNA, and the complexity of that. And this is a lot of complex stuff. In fact, people go and they make comments about what he said. They're arguing about, you know, he's a loon, he's crazy, he doesn't always talk about, he's a Bible freak trying to pose as a scientist. And they say he doesn't share any science in this article. This article is a page and a half long. Okay, there's no science in there. He's giving his conclusions, an opinion piece. He's written three books that are 500 pages long that are filled with evidence and details if they want to go to those and check those out. By the way, if you ever have insomnia, go read one of those three books, and that'll take care of those problems for you. But he's a brilliant scholar. I'm going to come back to this a bit later on. So there we have, this is kind of the introduction of my motivation. And so if there is no God, the Bible is not God's word. So how do we reach people who don't believe in God or his word? And so the article says the science, we need to understand and be aware of these things and be able to point towards that the possibility that science actually points towards God. In fact, God knows that. God states that. We'll get to that here in a moment. So the only way to change this is to change, people's worldview has to change. And that doesn't happen overnight. And that's where we're going to come with today's message. And so we're going to look at Genesis 1 through 12. I'm going to point things out and try to connect all these things. But we're going to start in Numbers and then go back to Genesis. And so Numbers chapter 14. I'll be there in a second. Read a verse. This is a little bit of background. Obviously, Moses is the author of Genesis. Moses was not around when Genesis took place. This is years and years later. Why did Moses write Genesis? Why did he write Exodus and those and all these books of the Pentateuch? And we can go back to a point here in Numbers chapter 14, I think specifically to answer a question why that takes place. These books were not written particularly to us. We benefit from them greatly. But these books were written for sons of Jacob, that family. And so we need to go back and see what's going on with them and why it was important for these books to be read. And then we can apply it to our own lives as well. So you know the story. I'm just going to read a quick verse here in Numbers 14. But the background is the people, Moses came, let my people go. Pharaoh says no, right? We all remember that. I'm just summing up really quickly because there's a lot involved. There are 10 plagues. Finally, they go out. So the people see all this, the Red Sea, they part, and now they're going, marching their way towards the promised land, and so they send in the 12 spies. Remember the song, right? 10 were bad, 2 were good. Okay, and they came back, and they give their report, and they say, oh, the land's beautiful, but they got really, really big guys there. They're going to squash us like bugs. And Caleb says, oh, we can take these guys. And then the other spy said, Caleb's crazy. Right? We know Caleb. Caleb loves to fight with everybody. It doesn't matter. Okay? And they're saying, we don't want to go. In fact, so here we are in verse, chapter 14, verse 3. The people cry out, why is the Lord bringing us into this land? There's a question. Why are we here? What is the Lord thinking? Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they start planning, we're going to go back. Okay, and Moses and Aaron fall and pray to God. And God said, fine, you don't want to go in there? I love this. You're not going to go. You know what? Caleb can go because he's tough. The rest of you guys, listen. I just brought you out of Egypt. Remember the plagues? Remember the Red Sea? I provided for you. I've taken care of you. I promised you. And you don't want to go? Fine. You need an attitude change. You need a worldview perspective change. Okay? And while you're wandering for 40 years in the wilderness and dying off, Moses is going to write these five books. And then your kids will learn about why you need to go into that land. That's what we're going to talk about going on from now. So going back to Genesis then, and again, I'm going to go through this. I've always talked too much, but I'll do my best to keep moving. I will definitely, I say I'll keep moving, but I always go on tangents, especially when we get to Genesis chapter 1. But I'm going to try to move through this relatively quickly. So Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And so this is titled In the Beginning. And I'm going to speak on In the Beginning again next week as well, but a different beginning, John chapter 1. Let's see how they are related, and they are. Okay, and so here we go. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and that's the starting point. It's interesting, right? Because you have to remember this. Moses is writing this information, and these books were read to the children of Israel before they entered the promised land. And so you have to go into your perspective thinking, what was going on for these last 40 years? Yes, they came out of Egypt, the 10 plagues, the Red Sea, manna every day. It was a reminder every day of God's provision for them. There was a cloud by day and a pillar of a fire by night present for 40 years. In other words, there is no attempt by Moses to defend the existence of God here because the people know God exists, right? They've experienced him. He's been in their presence for 40 years. Today, it's a different situation for us to try to defend that. Does God exist? The answer is yes or no. Okay, I'm going to say yes. Okay, it's not yes for you and no for me. It's either yes or no. And so either decision has implications. And that's kind of the key idea of the worldview change. There's a shift moving towards away from this scientific naturalist perspective, saying there's evidence for a designer, that's a step in. But it's going to take time to take on. And so there's no attempt by Moses to defend God. God created the heavens and the earth, and you know, I'm not going to go in detail, but you can go through this chapter. Day by day, he talks about the creation. Science says there's a beginning. Science says, okay, there's 13.8 billion years of the universe. And the Bible basically kind of suggests a time frame about 6,000 years. And so literally, if you look at the writing, the words of Genesis, Hebrew scholars, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, I'm relying on what they say, will tell you that the author of chapter one, or actually of these first books, are narrative, and the author's intent for the reader is to understand these as six literal days just a few thousand years ago. That's the intent of the author. Moses' intent is that. Where did Moses get this information? He wasn't around. He spent time on the mountain with God. God was telling him these things. He's writing these things down for us. So there was an eyewitness. Does God exist? According to Moses and the people of Israel, yes, he does. And this is what took place. Now, I think it's interesting because a lot of Christians have tried to bring in, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, the idea of an old earth and the creation story as well. On Stephen Meyer's article, even though he didn't talk at all about the age of the earth, he's just pointing to these evidences of science, a person named Bill, I'm kind of disappointed Bill's not here. I was going to point to him and see if he did this, but a person named Bill, who was he's a scientist, challenges this whole idea, but I want you to listen to his argument. He says this, This is his first statement. There wasn't a deity that created life on earth. It took 9 billion years before there was an earth. In other words, 13.8 billion years ago, the universe started, then earth formed 4.5 billion years ago. Life started to form 3.5 billion years ago. Get the idea? That's the evolutionist perspective. That's where he's coming from. Okay, so it took 9 billion years for the earth to even be there in the first place. That's his perspective, because that's what he believes. That's his worldview. So he says this, Meyer claims his God hypothesis is supported by recent science. I don't see, here's his point, why a creator would need to go through 9 billion years of random chaos before life starts on a planet. So why are Christians trying to take billions of years and put it into the Bible when an atheist says it makes no sense? If there's a creator, he doesn't need 9 billion years. He has more faith in a God he doesn't believe in than the Christians do. He goes on, if the choice is a random process or intelligent designer, the only way to choose is how long did it take? More than a billion years? Then it wasn't the product of an intelligence making men in their own image. Interesting. Okay, so there's no need for billions of years. I'm going to point that out going forward here a little bit. Let's look at verse 14 in chapter 1. I'll keep on moving here. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. There are, this book that we went through has plenty of arguments, and it goes through in detail. Ken Fleming does a very good job of research, bringing in, okay, some say this, what does the, and so it doesn't tell you what to believe, but it kind of leads you to say, you got to weigh the evidence. I'm going to do the same thing right now. So I'm going to do a couple of illustrations I've used in the past, some situations. I've taught on Genesis chapter 1, did the creation story. And this always comes up. This is the biggest question. You know, sunlight, right? Sun, stars, all that kind of thing. God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And so he put the two great lights out there, the sun and the moon. And by the way, we put the stars out there as well. Okay, kind of a sidelight. So we have, let me use some of the arguments that people come against me on the idea of, hey, this, sorry, doesn't make sense scientifically. Number one. On day three, God creates the plants. You go back a few verses. Okay, I had a PhD. This is kind of intimidating. I was at a church, and I sent a message on this. He came to me afterwards, and he was a PhD of all things at the University of Chicago. And he says, now, wait a minute. Okay, this is hogwash. Okay, and so he pointed out the fact, and he said, plants were created on day three. If the sun's created on day four, those plants would be all dead because the plants need the sun to stay alive. And I agreed with him. I said, you are correct. The sun is necessary for plants to be alive on the earth. Okay, but that's not what keeps plants alive. That's not the nourishment of plants. Okay, plants, you know, we breathe in oxygen, breathe out carbon dioxide. Plants breathe in carbon dioxide, and they need light. And sunlight is that light that basically feeds these plants. So I said, but it's not sunlight, it's light. And if you go back to the very beginning, light was created on day one. So we have light. As long as there's carbon dioxide, these plants are going to be fine. And he kind of stared at me and was processing that. And he says, we'll agree to disagree. And I was like, well, what's the problem with my perspective? In fact, do you need sunlight to grow plants? Has anybody noticed people growing plants in the basement where there's no sun? Yeah, right? Sunlight is not required. Light is required. And so that is not an issue. So that is one of those arguments that comes out, and there's an easy answer because God has provided it for us in the Bible. This is not a science textbook. Okay, it's not a science textbook. And so you can't go in there and look at all for all the equations to solve all the problems going forward. But where it deals with science, it's going to be accurate. The other issue is the distant starlight. This is one of my big hangups. I have to agree. I confess it was always a challenge for me. I've come to terms with it. Okay, I'll just put it that way. So distant starlight. If there's a star that's 15 billion light years away, it's going to take 15 billion years for that. I should say 50 because the universe is only 13.8 billion years old. That doesn't make any sense. Although they have found stars that are 15 billion light years away. I'll come back to that in a little bit. How can you have stars further away than the universe existed? Okay, so we have situations like that. So there's a problem there. But a guy named Dr. Russell Humphreys wrote a book, Starlight and Time. He's a Christian. He's an astrophysicist, and it's a wonderful book. You guys won't like it. It's a wonderful book. It has lots of math and science in there, okay? Lots of calculus and equations, differential equations. And he goes through there and he says, this is scientifically how God did the 6 days of creation, from my perspective, how it could have happened. He doesn't say for sure he wasn't there. So he starts off with that. But he comes up, he starts with some suppositions. I loved it. I'm going through the equations and following the calculus. Yes, yes, yes. And he shows the age of the Earth could be within 10,000 years mathematically using the same assumptions other scientists use, but changing the supposition just a little bit. The only difference he changes is the universe is bounded versus unbounded. Okay, so from a calculus standpoint, that changes a lot of things. Don't worry about all those details. So as I'm going through this, I'm going, yes, this is what I've been looking for. This helps me. And then a voice whispers in my ear. It wasn't my mom or my dad. It was just a voice. It wasn't a real voice. You understand that. And it said, I spoke it. And I kind of sat up. I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? Here is the science I'm looking, this is the math I've been looking for. And I started to contemplate on that for a week or two. And the idea was this. Genesis chapter 1, there's not one lick of science even in there. Okay? I want you to think about this. God spoke everything into existence. There's no science involved with that. But when God does something, he does it the right way. The term Dr. Dave Reed used to call it fully functional. When he created man, he was fully functional. Okay? He didn't go through the baby stage, didn't go through the toddler stage, didn't go through the teenage stage. He was a fully functional man. His mind worked. He could communicate. He had a shave, maybe, I don't know. But the whole idea was he was fully functional. Everything that he needed to be in that state was already there. From our perspective, that's a miracle. Okay, how do you scientifically prove a miracle? And so when he created the stars, this is where I've come to basically accept this. All of that, whatever it needed to be, gravitational pull, the idea of the distance, the light moving, God had to do that because it was fully functional from the beginning, and he can do that. Okay, that alleviates that problem that our friend Bill says, the idea of, you know, God doesn't need to be billions of years. When he created it just the way it needed to be. Now, people say, well, that's not very scientific. And they'll say, you can't use that. Science says that this and starlight. You know, the problem is this. Science itself has issues with distant starlight. Okay, they don't confess that. So they can't say, okay, distant starlight basically says that a biblical creation perspective is thrown out if they have the same type of problem themselves. Are you following along with that? In other words, all you got to do is go, hey, what about the horizon? There's the word, horizon problem. That's the same problem in the reverse direction. Okay, and so they have a problem too. Does that throw out your perspective? And they'll say, no, of course not, because it's science. Well, your science has a problem. So both of these have the same type of problem going forward. I am really going slow. Let's move. More could be said. Okay. chapter 2. I'm going to go through this very quickly. The seventh day. Okay, on the seventh day, chapter 2, basically, I'm trying to tie these together. The creation is all there. Adam and Eve are created on in chapter 1. And then chapter 2 kind of goes through the seventh day, a day of rest, and reiterates Adam and Eve meeting. Remember, so basically Adam goes and he names all the animals. There's not a person that corresponds to him. So Eve is brought into the picture. This is basically the establishment of biblical marriage in chapter 2. And Jesus reaffirms that in the New Testament as well. I should go in the end of chapter 1. I should also say, it's the important part. I'll come back to it again later on. Verse 28 says, be fruitful and multiply. That's the mandate, the biblical mandate. God tells them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. That is what they're supposed to do. Chapter 3, then, going forward. We know about chapter 3, the fall, okay? Adam and Eve's sin, terrible story, but it's an important part of what's going on. God created in chapter 2, a man and woman together in harmony, walking in the garden. Think about this, walking with God in the garden with fellowship with God. Hard to understand that ability to be that close, but that's what the way they were. Chapter 3, that separation takes place. They sin, God casts them out of the garden, that the closeness is taken away. But we have chapter verse 15, the great promise of a future. And we'll get more of this, obviously, next week, Lord willing, goes forward. Verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. And so there's that prophecy of help to the situation they're in right now. But now we're in that situation. Chapter 4, things do not get better, things get worse. Cain is born. And Eve, there is some perspective that says that Eve names Cain because she thinks this is the actual fulfillment that God said back in chapter 3. A man will be provided. She thinks he might be the one. He's born. Okay? He's not. Right? He's not. Cain and his brother Abel. Okay? Abel brings a sacrifice. Was accepted. Cain was not accepted. And there's strife. God warns Cain, come on, let it go. Deal with it. Okay? And Cain kills his brother. Okay? Sin, you know, eating an apple. We're already at murder in chapter 3. We're going very quickly. And then the end of that chapter, we go through Cain's lineage. Okay? He gets married, has offspring. Notice, though, it goes very quickly and it ends at the very end. And then at the very end of that chapter, Seth is born. And then chapter 5 talks about Adam's descendants through Seth up through Noah. And so it's important there. Let's go through, just read a few verses, how it goes. Adam lived 130 years. He fathered a son in his own likeness and after his image, and he named him Seth. The days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Same pattern goes on over and over. You've read this before. It's like, that seems kind of boring. It's important, though. The idea is this. He lived so long. He had children. He had this son. He had other sons and daughters. He lived this many years. He died. That person, okay, lived this long, had this son. He had other sons and daughters. He died, right? Then you get to a special man. His name was Enoch, verse 21. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God. After he fathered Methuselah 300 years, he had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. It's kind of exciting. There's a difference here, though. We have the idea of sin, and it's getting worse and worse. You have people developing, and you have this guy named Enoch, and it's very specific. It says it twice. He walked with God. Remember Adam and Eve? They walked with God in the garden. Here's Enoch now. He's walking with God. Now, to walk with somebody, you've got to be going the same direction, right? Otherwise, you're not walking with that person. And so here's a special situation. Enoch walked with God. And then you have other sons and daughters. And he gets to Noah at the end of chapter 5. Chapter 6, evil in the world continues. Verse 5, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only, let me say that again, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart, of man's heart, was only evil continually. Only evil continually. Those words there are trying to emphasize the fact that this was not a nice place to be living in. Okay, George had a prayer this morning. People are struggling today. It was, I'm going to say what's worse. We're getting to that point right now, but it was even worse at this time. And God regretted he had made man. So he calls Noah, and look at what it says about Noah in verse 9. Noah was a righteous man, so in all of this evil, blameless in his generation, Noah walked with God. There you have it again. So he's going in that direction. And you know the story. He tells Noah, I want you to build an ark. I'm going to destroy the earth. Chapter 7, the flood comes. Very quickly, science basically confirms the fact that a worldwide flood. Let me tell you a quick story about this. I get very excited at certain times. I'm watching a documentary on TV. My wife, we're going to a wedding. I can't remember whose wedding it was. My wife is getting ready. She takes longer than me to get ready. So here I am watching TV while she's finishing up. And the documentary was, what happened to the dinosaurs? And of course, the dinosaur perspective is a comet came down, the Gulf of Mexico, boom, you know, dinosaurs went extinct after that point. They have a different perspective. And their perspective was, the evidence is leading us to believe, notice the words, the evidence is leading us to believe there were continent-sized floods all over the earth. They didn't say a worldwide flood. They said continent-sized floods all over the earth. That's what the evidence shows. And so in other words, if there's a continent-sized flood in, you know, China and Russia, what does the rest of the world look like? If that whole continent is flooded, the whole world is flooded. But if they say the evidence points to the idea of a worldwide flood, what does that mean? The Bible must be true. We don't want people to believe that. So we can't say that. So the evidence actually points to this taking place. Chapter 8. Very quickly, exiting the ark, and then it goes into chapter 9. I don't want to miss these, are kind of important things, but God's covenant with Noah actually starts in chapter 8, the very end, verses 21. And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. Noah comes out, gives a sacrifice. The Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. He knows what's going on there. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done while the earth remains. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will not cease. And in the verse chapter 9, he says that the idea of the rain, the bow and the clouds is a sign as well going forward. Chapter 10. Chapter 9 ends with the idea of the descendants of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In fact, we're all descendants of them as well. I think it's kind of interesting. They kind of located the fact, they've done some archaeology. It looks like Shem basically settled in the Middle East area, where Turkey is right now. Ham went by to Egypt and into Africa. Japheth went up into Europe and then into Asia. That was how they settled. So you can kind of figure out, okay, where your descendants came from. You can say, well, I'm probably a descendant of Shem, Ham, or Japheth from those perspectives of where they went to. But there was a guy in chapter 10, his name was Nimrod in verse 8. He was a mighty man. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. And they've come to the conclusion that he was the first dictator. He decided, because God's mandate to Noah was be fruitful and multiply, just like he said to Adam and Eve. And Nimrod said, no, I want you all around me. And basically he wanted to become in control of all things. And that's where the Tower of Babel actually started. In fact, it tells us that Nimrod was the source of that, building that that tower. And so Nimrod basically forbade people from obeying God. Isn't it interesting? Do we have dictators that do that today? We do. So he's the first of those types going forward. Chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel. We know what happened because they were trying to do this. God confused their languages. There are over 7,000 languages today. Linguists have basically trace these languages back to 10 core languages. In other words, you can go back and say, this is where all these languages kind of basically evolved from, so to speak, over the years. And so there was one language, now there were probably 10, and so they separated based on that. And then the key to where I want to get to the question, the children of Israel say, why did God bring us here? Chapter 12. Whew. I'm going fast now, but it says this. The Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. Go to the land I'm going to show you. Verse 2, and I will make you a great nation. So here's Moses or Joshua before the people go into the promised land. He's reading this. Here is our history. By the way, again, the history of mankind from Genesis 1 through 11, that time period is much longer than the time period from chapter 12 to the rest of the Bible. In other words, there's a long period of time in that time frame. But he's saying, here's our history. God created you, okay, to walk with him, to be with us, to have fellowship. But man sinned. But God provided a way of escape. He promised a future man who will deliver us from these problems in Genesis 3:15. And he goes through and he talks about all of the history of our of the people. And he gets to Abram and he says, now, the reason we're going in there is because God promised Abram a nation, a huge nation. That's you. God promised Abram years and years ago, you. You are a fulfillment to that promise. And he promised Abram that land across the river. And God keeps his promises. Kind of interesting. And so the people went across and they took the land. Now, of course, it wasn't perfect. So my point is, that's kind of today's lesson, trying to put it all together. How does that apply to us? And the same questions can be applied. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? So the same answers apply to us. Where do we come from? We're not the children of Israel. Okay? But we all originate from Adam and Eve and from Noah's sons as well. We're all part of that same family. And God's desire has not changed. His desire from Genesis chapter 1 was be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and walk with me. He tells Noah, be fruitful and multiply. God does not change. He's consistent. The problem is us, right? We keep trying to move away. The key is we need to walk with him. That's what he says. So that is, the question is, where do we come from? Why are we here? The purpose is that God wants to walk with us. He wants us to walk with him. And so that is my encouragement to you today. Okay, get in the word. How can I walk with him better? This world is in disarray. But you know what that means? It's ready for a revival. What it needs is to see people walking with God. It needs Enoch. It needs Noah. It needs to see these people and say, I want what they have. Okay? We've been praying for that in Dubuque, and we've been seeing that taking place a little bit. And then where are we going? I thought it was interesting in George Prayer, he kind of mentioned this as well. I'm going to go all the way back to Revelation 22 and verse 12. Where are we going? While we're here, we want to walk with God, but Jesus promises us, behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done. So at the very beginning, I said the question is this. We can ask people, do you believe in God? No. Okay. Yes or no? Why not? Why? Here are the ramifications. Okay. The idea is there are going to be ramifications either way. If you believe, there's going to be recompense. I believe. I put my faith in him. I don't. There's going to be punishment. Are you prepared for that? Well, I don't believe in God, so I don't believe in punishment. Well, it doesn't matter if you don't believe or not. If God exists, you're going to be punished. The flood tells us that. Right? And we'll talk about that as well. My time is gone. I apologize for going a little bit over. But we will continue in the beginning, Lord willing, next Sunday as well. Let's close in prayer. Lord, I do thank you. I do thank you for your word. I do thank you for the history. I thank you for these books that were not necessarily written for us, but are written exactly for us, that we can use this information and be encouraged to know that you are a God who fulfills promises, and you have promised to come back for us, and we look forward to that day. I pray in our daily lives for opportunities. I pray just to share our life story and to share Jesus with those who want to hear. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.